Lesnar got caught.
He's gonna tap. He's gonna tap.
I think this is
Lesnar. Oh man, Brock Lesnar. Look at Lesnar.
Oh my God.
Lesnar reversing, countering out now, hammering away at Cena again.
Stop! He's already dead.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 342. This is the Solid Monster Sounds Off podcast here for Sunday, August 24th. 2014. I am the Solemn Monster. Happy birthday, Vince McMahon. Turns 69 years old today. the fun they would have with that if this was still the Attitude Era. That's all I'm going to say about that. Thank you, as always, for downloading the podcast via whatever means, be it iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio. We're available through all of those services and more. And I also want to thank everybody who's been helping out with the Audible trials. You guys have been signing up for a lot of them, getting a lot of your friends and family to sign up. So I appreciate that a lot. We had a big, big month in the month of July, and we are on our way to setting new records here in the month of August. We already shattered the previous record, and we could even get that a little bit higher. So we have about another, 8 days maybe left in the month of August, something like that, 7 days. So if you want to sign up for an Audible trial, if you haven't tried it before, now's the time to do it. And you can do so using the URL audibletrial.com/solemonster. It's a free audiobook service that you can use for 30 days. Free for the first 30. You can certainly cancel anytime you want to, but if you like it, you can stick with it and then pay month to month. But you get a free audiobook when you sign up. You can try it out. There's a lot of different books, thousands, tens of thousands of books that you can choose from. Be it wrestling related or not, doesn't really matter. And you can listen to them on the run, on the go, on your way to work, school, whatever is convenient for you. So if you do want to give it a shot, please use our URL, audibletrial.com/solemonster, and then tweet me and let me know what book you pick and what you think of it. So I would appreciate it if you can do that. I also have some PayPal shout-outs this week. Not as many as usual, but two people who were very kind to make a PayPal donation to the podcast this past week. Dashing David Vera and Charismatic Christian Jones. Thank you guys very much. I appreciate it. You can donate $10 or more for a wrestling nickname. You can always make a PayPal donation on thesolemonster.com. The PayPal box is on the right-hand side. Whatever amount you decide to donate is entirely up to you. And just know that I am appreciative for your contributions. Now, SummerSlam was this past week. Last weekend, in fact, live from Los Angeles. The final LA SummerSlam, at least for a year, since they're coming to the East Coast next year. I posted a full review of last weekend's SummerSlam pay-per-view as a sound-off extra, a rare sound-off extra post-pay-per-view review, exclusively on YouTube, and there is an MP3 link for those of you who want to download it, put it on your device, in the description of the video. But it does not push to iTunes, it does not push to Stitcher, it is YouTube-exclusive content for our YouTube channel. Hopefully, if you have not already subscribed, you will do so. A lot of people were not expecting a sound-off extra to go up, and when it did, those people who were subscribed were the first to know because you guys got a push notification about that. So please subscribe to our YouTube channel and go up there and listen to the full review. I'm not going to go into all of the different matches of the pay-per-view. I'm just going to say this. It was the first main event squash match in SummerSlam history, and I loved every second of it. It was fantastic. I love the outcome of the main event. It was the right move to make. Brock Lesnar destroying John Cena to become the new WWE World Heavyweight Champion in pretty shocking fashion. I don't think anybody would have predicted that John Cena would have taken that kind of beating and just gotten destroyed the way that he did as the top guy in the company. And to go out there and sacrifice himself, both as a character and literally sacrifice himself and get the shit beaten out of him for about 15 minutes straight and dropped on his head and dropped on the back of his neck. You know, Cena's got that scar on his neck, on his throat, if you ever really notice it, because he's had neck surgery before. So I'm sure that didn't feel too good, getting dropped on the back of your head 15 times in a row. So my hat's off to John Cena for agreeing to go through with the match as it was laid out. There are a lot of top guys in his position who would have seen that or who would have had that idea pitched to them and would have said, are you out of your freaking mind? And I could think, I mean, Hogan, Austin, believe me, a lot of those guys would never have allowed themselves to look that bad in the main event on pay-per-view the way that John Cena did. He went along with it. He said, okay, if that's the plan, then so be it. So I give him a lot of credit for that. And it was everything that it should have been, in my opinion. I know some people were bored by it. I talk about this in the YouTube video. You know, at the end of the day, they were trying to tell a story. It's up to you. If you were bored by it, then look, different strokes for different folks. They were trying to tell a story. There are people who didn't get it. They didn't get that story. I didn't, you know, they're not stupid. They're not dumb. They just didn't get it. And even the people who got it still might think it was boring. I didn't think it was boring at all. Was it a little slow in points where Brock was just kind of standing there telling the referee, ask him if he wants to give up? Yeah, I mean, maybe he could have, you know, beaten him up a little bit more. Or he could have gone for the pin, maybe have some more near falls. But again, the story they were trying to tell was he did not want to pin John Cena so much as he wanted John Cena to quit. He wanted him to give up. He wanted him to tap out. Because that goes against everything the John Cena character believes. And he comes out with a little towel before every match that specifically says, never give up. And in the end, John Cena did not give up. Brock Lesnar did pin him with an F5 and won the championship. He avenged his loss 2 years ago at Extreme Rules. And everything I loved about that Extreme Rules match, aside from the finish, was everything I loved about this match. It was a match that was just different. It was different than any other main event we've ever seen on a WWE pay-per-view. Now, these two guys went out there and did it again. Two times in a row, they gave us a match, a main event we have never seen in this company before. And it also was a match that made some people, anyway, uncomfortable. That's what Brock Lesnar does. He doesn't go out there to entertain you and wrestle a wrestling match, a sports entertainment match like anybody else on the roster would do. He goes out there, he beats the crap out of people. He's a fighter. He's got the fighting gloves. He's grounded and pounded and beaten the crap out of his opponents. And generally speaking, he wants to make you feel uncomfortable. And I think mission accomplished, if that was the goal at SummerSlam. And you may recall last year's SummerSlam, I said, I thought was the best in 10 years. You had two match of the year candidates on that one pay-per-view, Brock Lesnar and CM Punk, John Cena and Daniel Bryan, who I think went out there, had an excellent match, and then they did the whole Money in the Bank swerve at the end, which I thought at the time was great. I thought as swerves go, it was actually really well done. The people were into it. Yeah, some people saw it coming, not everybody did. I just thought last year's SummerSlam overall, and because of those two top matches, was the best SummerSlam pay-per-view in a decade. Now that's more of an indictment on how many lackluster SummerSlams we've had over the last decade. They all just sort of blend together for me. None of them really stand out. To be honest with you, I'd have to go back to, I guess, you know, 2010, I guess, Team WWE against the Nexus. I wouldn't call that a good show, and that main event had an awful finish. Before that, I'd probably have to go back to the Icon vs. Legend match they did with Hogan and Michaels, which was in 2005, which was almost a decade ago. You know, these pay-per-views now, there's no real identity like they used to have 20 years ago. When SummerSlam would roll around, each show would have an identity. Just the way that it was produced and, I guess, the matches themselves. I'm not even going to say that all those SummerSlams back in the late 80s, early 90s were all winners. I mean, you had some dud matches on there. But they had an identity. And these shows now, they really don't. It's like, it's SummerSlam, and it's just like any other show. The set they use, it's now the Raw set. I know they're cutting costs, but I mean, for God's sakes, do something to make this show stand out. It's one of your top three big pay-per-views of the year. You know, you don't have to go gaga for Battleground or some of those shows, but for SummerSlam, you know, you expect a little bit more, so that was a little bit disappointing. But last year's was great. This year's, I thought overall, in terms of match quality, top to bottom, was right behind 2013. Probably the second best SummerSlam top to bottom in 10 years, in my opinion. So that's my thoughts on SummerSlam. And that dovetails into what I want to talk about next. And I hope Trax picks this up because it could make for some interesting discussion on his channel. And that is, now that Brock Lesnar is the WWE champion, who does he wrestle? We know who his first opponent's going to be next month, but if he holds on to that title for longer than 1 month, which he should, who are some of the potential opponents for Brock Lesnar? Now, this is assuming that Brock would have agreed to work some additional pay-per-view dates between now and WrestleMania 31, which I think is his last date under contract. At least that's those were the reports when he first came back and how long he was going to be under contract for. It may have even come out. I don't remember exactly, but I just know that he's in until WrestleMania 31. I guess at that point they could extend him. Now that pay-per-views are being phased out, you've got the network, things are a little bit different. Would they be willing to pay Brock Lesnar a couple of million dollars to keep him on? You know, I guess that's a question they're going to have to ask. I think he's worth it. I just think he's such a unique performer in that company. He's so different than everybody else, and the Heyman-Lesnar act is so great that I would do whatever I have to do to keep this guy under contract and keep him from going back to UFC and making Dana White a whole bunch of money, but that's just me. So this is assuming that Brock would agree or has maybe already agreed to work one or two more pay-per-view dates. I don't see him working that many more television shows. I don't see him working any house shows unless it's a really, really big house show that's near where he lives, and then maybe he'd be willing to do it. But this is a list of potential challengers that they might consider even for one or two B-show defenses over the next several months. We're not talking Raw matches. Brock Lesnar should not be wrestling on Raw. I think Paul Heyman made that comment on TV once. Brock Lesnar does not wrestle for free. I agree with that. We have John Cena. John Cena has already been announced as the number one contender. He is getting his rematch with Lesnar at Night of Champions, September 21st. I think that they're rushing into this match way too quickly, but that's just the nature of the beast, I guess. And he's due a rematch, so it's going to be Cena-Lesnar 3. I'm not counting their backlash match from 11 years ago, so please don't throw that in my face. The question here is, would they put the title back on John Cena so quickly to get him to number 16? There were a lot of mentions about the number 16 at SummerSlam. 16 suplex. I think it was actually 15 Germans and then one regular suplex. But let's just say 16 suplexes. John Cena got dropped on his head at SummerSlam. I think the match went 16 minutes long. Maybe just a coincidence. But to me, it worries me that this is part of a story that they're going to want to tell, where in the end, John Cena gets his revenge, and it happens to be number 16 in terms of the 16th world title that he wins. Now, here's what I think. Maybe they don't want an absentee champion, and Brock is not working more pay-per-views. He's not open to it. I don't care how much money you pay me. I'm not doing it. I have my dates, and I'm happy, and that's it. Let's say that's the case. Would they have Cena win, only to have Seth Rollins then cash in Money in the Bank and beat him for the title that same night? Or maybe even the next night on Raw. I personally don't see them wasting John Cena's record-tying 16th reign when he ties Ric Flair, even though Ric Flair has won more than 16 titles. But that's the number of reigns they love to promote for Flair. I just think it would be a huge waste to finally have Cena win number 16, which he is going to at some point, and then 5 minutes later, or 24 hours later, have him drop the belt to somebody else. But if they did, I can't say I would be completely upset about the possibility of a Seth Rollins versus Dean Ambrose Hell in a Cell match in October for the title. Of course, that begs the question, what do you do with John Cena in that case? If Cena's not wrestling for the title, then you may as well just keep the title on Brock Lesnar. It's not like Rollins and Ambrose need a title. But with the kind of matches these guys have been having and the reactions they've been getting from the fans, I could buy into it. And I bet you Joe Blow in the crowd, who's not on the internet, you know, talking about this stuff or doesn't know anything about these guys' backgrounds on the indies and has been following them all their lives and all that kind of stuff, they could buy into that match too. I mean, these guys are that good, and they've been promoted really as main eventers from day one as members of the Shield. It's not as though I think people look at them, you know, a few notches below. They're pretty much in that main event mix. Maybe they're not right at the tippy top. They're not there yet, but they're right in that main event mix. I don't think people would have a problem at all if they wanted to go in that direction. I mean, it could even help elevate both guys to that next level in the eyes of the fans if they're wrestling for the top title in the company. Hey, I mean, hey, it worked for Rock and Mick Foley. Late 98, early 99. Those guys went back and forth. I don't need to see Rollins and Ambrose trading the title back 5 million times like those guys did. But they had enough matches, Rock and Foley did, and they were positioned in the main event. You know, Austin wasn't really involved in that feud. It went on for about 2 or 3 months. And I think in a lot of ways, it really helped cement those guys in that top position. And Rock went on to headline WrestleMania against Austin in 99. So you could draw those comparisons. I'd have no problem with it. I still, at the end of the day, would not take the title off Brock Lesnar. I just think it would be a huge mistake. It would just be a huge mistake after what they did at SummerSlam, as perfect as it was. And now they've got this monster of a guy who's got their championship held hostage. And they could run with this for months. And instead they panic. Or maybe they don't panic. Maybe it's part of their plan all along. Let's get Cena to 16. Let's get him that big win at Night of Champions. You're going to have a lot of really pissed off network subscribers, I think, if you do that. I think Cena has to go out there and have a competitive match. You can't do the same match you did at SummerSlam twice. You just, it won't work. Cena has to come back, make it maybe a no DQ match so Cena can use weapons and stuff, and he just has to go out there and just go head on against Brock and show some life and show some offense this time and have a more competitive match. But in the end, whether he has to cheat or he does it clean like he did last Sunday, Brock wins. It's the only outcome here that really does make sense. Brock has to win. He's got to keep the belt, but Cena does have to look competitive. You can't make him look like a pussy 2 months in a row. You know, you do it one time, a one-time squash the way they did it last weekend is fine, but then you reach that point where, okay, people are looking forward to this pay-per-view main event. You can't have another squash match 2 months in a row. You know, Cena has to show some kind of life this time. And it's weird because, you know, they had him cut that promo on Raw. I think it was on the go-home show before SummerSlam. And Cena's out there and he's like, listen, I know what I'm up against at SummerSlam and I want you people to know you're going to see a side of me that you've never seen before. You're going to see an evil side of John Cena. You're going to see, you know, a mean side of me that hasn't really come out before. And we didn't see any of that at SummerSlam. So I'm not really sure what the hell was the point of that promo now that I think about it. I almost forgot about that. They've got to show some of that at the next pay-per-view, but Brock should not be losing. We have Batista. What about Batista? He was out, right, promoting his Guardians of the Galaxy movie, and he may still be doing promotion for it if the movie is being released in international markets. I think the lion's share of his promotion for it now is done, or it's coming to an end. And he has said he is going to be back. He's under contract, I think. When he came back, it was a 2-year contract, I think he said in interviews. And so he's got plenty of time left with WWE. Do you do a Brock Lesnar versus Batista feud once the Cena feud has run its course? I think that would be a big match. I think a lot of people would love to see it. I think it might be the only way you could get people to cheer for Batista. I don't think Batista comes back to feud with Brock Lesnar and gets booed the way that he was booed when he came back before. I'm not going to say he's going to be 100% cheered, but I do think that people would look at him more as a babyface and not as, you know, boo Tista, we don't want to see you, we don't want you back. Because he's not coming back to take a spot from, you know, the beloved Daniel Bryan, which is what really ticked off a lot of people back in January. You know, he's coming back in this case to go up against another part-time guy who a lot of people don't like. You know, Brock has his fans. You know, I'm a fan of Brock Lesnar, but there are a lot of people who don't like the guy. And they don't think he deserves to be the champion. They don't think he deserves to be the one to end the Undertaker streak. They're appalled by this. So I think it could work. You know, face heel dynamic, two big guys who never have had a real feud on WWE television before. I think they had a match in OVW when they were first starting out, but they never really wrestled. They never had a feud. They never wrestled for the championship. That'd be a big time match. I think they could definitely do it. I guess the only question then would be when. Do you do it on a B show? Do you do it at Survivor Series? I think Brock and Batista as the main event of Survivor Series absolutely would work. I mean, they teased this feud as a possibility earlier this year on Raw. Very briefly, there was an in-ring promo. If you remember, Lesnar and Heyman were in the ring, and Batista was in the ring too, and they kind of in a very subtle way teased the idea that, hey, maybe these guys are going to wrestle at some point, and then they never went back to it. I think we could definitely see it. And Survivor Series would probably be the place to do it. I wouldn't have Batista win. I still would keep the belt on Brock. I'd keep the belt on Brock through Mania next year, but it would make for a big match. What about Big Show? Big Show and Brock have a history together. Big Show and Brock wrestled at the Royal Rumble earlier this year, if you can call it wrestling. It was more of an angle than a match. Brock went out there with a steel chair, and he beat the piss out of Big Show, and that was kind of it. that was really all that there was to it. There was never any follow-up. There was never a rematch. Before that match took place, I think I said on the podcast here, I was kind of looking forward to Brock and Big Show. And that surprised some people because they didn't think it would really be a good match. I remember back in 2003, these two guys having a hell of a stretcher match at one of the Judgment Day pay-per-views. It might have been that year. They went out there and with this god-awful stipulation because stretcher matches in WWE are freaking lame. Okay, the fact that you have to get a guy in a gurney and roll him across a line, I mean, what is this, a fucking game show? I just think the way they use that stipulation is so stupid. But they made it work in that match, and I thought they had a hell of a match. They had some good matches during that feud. That was also 11 years ago. And you're talking about two big guys now who are 11 years older, whose bodies are 11 years older. I'm not expecting them to go out there and have a great match, but there is the history there if they wanted to go back there. You know, Big Show is looking to slay the beast and get revenge on Lesnar for that chair assault on him at the Royal Rumble. And as a one-off on pay-per-view on one of the B-shows, I wouldn't have a problem with that at all, provided that Brock wins. So Big Show could be a challenger for him if he's going to have some matches between now and Rumble, or between now and Mania. You could do Brock and Big Show on a B-show. You could do Brock and Big Show again at the Rumble and come back with it, only this time let them have an actual match. What about Mark Henry, Big Show's new tag team partner? Mark Henry, no less than twice on Raw several months ago, came out to confront Brock Lesnar and had the shit kicked out of him. He got F5'd on the floor, and there was never any mention of it again after that. They never revisited it. There was never a match between the two of them, obviously, because Brock's not wrestling on TV. But Henry is another guy who has history with Brock. Again, he's been laid out and never got a match out of it. It would be a fresh match that we haven't seen this go-around. I think the two of them had a match one time on SmackDown back in 02, and that was it. I remember being impressed by it, too, because Brock got Mark Henry up for the F5 and held him up there on his shoulders and then gave him the move. And that's when I knew, wow, this guy is a beast. So I'm just putting Henry's name out there. It could be another potential B-show title defense if they wanted to go in that direction. I probably would not. They've got Henry slotted with Rusev now, plus he's doing the tag team thing with Big Show. You know, if Brock did agree to do some B-shows, I would think maybe two at the most, plus Survivor Series and Rumble, and that's it. You know, he doesn't even have to wrestle in February. I wouldn't have him wrestling in February. So, really, we're looking at two potential opponents. I don't know that I would waste it on Henry. I'm just putting his name on there because there is a history there, and they could go in that direction. Then that brings us to Cesaro. Cesaro, they have some work to do here, but it is still doable if they build Cesaro back up and then play off his history with Paul Heyman. The idea of Cesaro showing off his strength and getting a few spots in where he throws Brock around the way that Brock throws other people around, the way that Brock threw around John Cena like a rag doll last Sunday, the idea of having Cesaro get a few spots in there where he does the same thing to Brock, and Brock actually shows some moments of weakness and really gets the crowd into it and gets the crowd to rally around Cesaro that he might be the guy to take the title from him. You know, the guy who body slammed Big Show out of the ring at the Andre the Giant Battle Royal at WrestleMania. Feels like a lifetime ago, given what they've done with Cesaro, but that was probably the biggest moment of his career up to that point. A match between Lesnar and Cesaro, I think it's right up there with Batista. I think Cesaro is one of those guys, of all the guys I'm listing here, who makes the most sense if they can build him back up. They've done such a horrendously poor job of making Cesaro mean anything over the last few months, ever since WrestleMania. He's done nothing. The pairing with him and Heyman, which had so much potential, was a failure. It did nothing to help Heyman. It didn't tie into the Lesnar story at all. I thought they would build up some jealousy there. Heyman comes out every single week. He's crowing about, my client broke the streak. At some point, Cesaro just kind of turns to him and says, hey, what about me? What am I? But they didn't do it. And it sure as hell didn't do anything for Cesaro, so I still fail to see what that pairing did for any of the people involved. It just killed time. That's really all it did. It killed time while Brock was away for Heyman to have somebody to go out there with until it was time for Brock to come back and play. But they could have gotten so much more out of it. If they pull their head out of their ass, they could still salvage him and make him a believable opponent for Lesnar if he starts winning matches now. Okay, they got to start right now. He beat Jack Swagger on Monday night. It was, you know, a big deal. But he should be winning more matches week after week after week and start building this guy back up so that when Royal Rumble rolls around, you could do Lesnar versus Cesaro. And Cesaro doesn't win, but I think that even in defeat, that match could help Cesaro get over to that next level, even if he loses. He could come close, but in the end, he fails. Those guys go out there, you give them 12, 15, 20 minutes, they have a great match. This guy, he's made. Now you finally built Cesaro back up to a level where people can buy him, you know, if not as a main eventer, at something close to that level. And it shows that Brock is not invincible. It shows that Brock can be beaten, but even this guy couldn't get the job done. And then you go to WrestleMania from there, because I don't think Brock should defend in February. You go to WrestleMania, and whoever it is, whether it's, you know, Roman Reigns or whoever, they finally slay the beast and get the big win. Kurt Angle is another interesting one. Latest reports suggest that Kurt reached out to Triple H about coming back to WWE with a limited schedule, and Triple H basically blew him off. And so Kurt, not one to take no for an answer, apparently reached out to Vince McMahon directly, and Vince told him, hey, Paul's the one who makes those decisions now. You got to deal with him. And when Triple H found out about it, he was livid. He was livid that Kurt Angle went over his head to Vince. Sounds to me like Vince really does not want Kurt Angle back. He knows the issues that he's gone through before. Supposedly, there's the story that years ago he made it very well known to people in the company that he didn't want an Olympic gold medalist to die on his watch. He just did not want that stench attached to him and his company. So who knows? Whether it was Triple H, his hands were tied, he was kind of acting as the bad cop, he knew what Vince wanted, and so he told Kurt, we're not interested. Or maybe Triple H really doesn't like Kurt, and he doesn't want Kurt back himself, because he knows Kurt can be a train wreck. You know, whatever the case may be, it definitely seems like they're not going to want Kurt back now, after that little stunt that he supposedly pulled. And it's a shame, too, because the timing could not be more perfect, with his TNA contract expiring next month. It's really a shame that Kurt wrecked his body, because a healthy Kurt Angle, even at 45 years old, could have a good match with Brock Lesnar. You know, I know the Brock Lesnar we saw in 2003 is not the same Brock Lesnar today, but I still think those two would bring out the best in each other, because they're so damn competitive, especially with each other. You know, always probably one guy probably thinks he's better than the other. You know, there was always that competition between the two of them. Given how fragile Kurt Angle is at this point, he's seemingly made of glass. Every time he comes back in TNA, he's out with another injury. He tore this or his knee or, you know, his neck or whatever it may be. I would just as soon rather not see him back in the ring, let alone go in there with a guy like Lesnar who would freaking kill him. But we're just talking possibilities here. Lots of you seem to think that if Kurt Angle does come back, a match with Rusev would make the most sense. USA versus Russia. I guess so, but Rusev is coming off a feud with a guy that used the ankle lock as his finish. All Rusev's been doing lately is selling the ankle. So now he's going to go right into another feud where his opponent's finishing move targets the ankle. Kurt back in a WWE ring seems very unlikely at this point, but if the circumstances were different, one more Angle versus Lesnar feud could have been money, in my opinion. Daniel Bryan. David Shoemaker of Grantland tweeted this week that he's been hearing Bryan needs Tommy John surgery, which is where they replace a ligament in the elbow with a tendon they find somewhere else in your body. Those in WWE reportedly say that decision still has not been made. They're not confirming it. They're not denying it. They're just saying that he may need surgery. He may not need surgery. They're not saying what it is, but that's all up in the air at this point. You mostly hear about pitchers in baseball having Tommy John surgery. It's actually named after a former pitcher. As a Mets fan, I am all too familiar with that surgery. We've got two pitchers out right now recovering from it, Bobby Parnell and Matt Harvey. No relation to Jeff Harvey of the legendary Harvey Brothers tag team. Thank you, Mike Adamley. You also hear stories of more and more parents having doctors perform the surgery on their kids because they think it'll help them throw harder. I'm always amazed when I read stories like that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with their kid's arm, but they want somebody to cut them open and have holes drilled into their arm so that maybe they'll be able to pitch better. I remember reading a story about this. You know, James Andrews, whose name wrestling fans will know because many wrestlers swear by the guy whenever they need to be operated on. He's the guy who repaired both of Triple H's quads. He's WWE's go-to guy, but he's also the go-to guy for a lot of other athletes. He's kind of the guy who perfected the operation. And he'll have parents come to him with their perfectly healthy kid to get the surgery, and he'll refuse out of principle. And they get angry with him. Parents like that should have their kids taken away from them until they complete a psych evaluation. It's too bad their parents didn't take them to a brain surgeon to be operated on when they were kids to make them smarter. It just pisses me off whenever I hear about that. When I hear Tommy John, I always think now of the idiotic parents who do that kind of thing now. But anyway, if Brian does get the surgery, if what Shoemaker tweeted out turns out to be true, that would put him out another 3 months. Pitchers usually miss. They miss a long time. They miss an entire season and then some. So we're talking like 12 to 18 months usually that a pitcher will miss. Brian's not out there hurling fastball, so I doubt he'd have to be out that long. From what Brian has said in interviews, his neck is fine. It's just the nerve issue in his arm that he's been dealing with. He still has no strength in his right arm. So if all goes well, that would put him right on target for a comeback right around Royal Rumble if they wanted to hold him out a little bit of extra time, which is what I would do. So even if at the end of December he gets a clean bill of health, he's cleared to wrestle, I'd hold him out until the Rumble and really build up his return. But back to Brian and Brock, how this ties into Brock Lesnar. It was supposed to be the SummerSlam main event this year. Didn't happen that way. Would they have had Lesnar go in there and destroy Brian the way he did Cena? That I don't know. I think because Cena was the top guy, they were trying to tell a story with Cena. I would think that with Brian, they would have had a more competitive match, but who knows? You know, Brian's smaller than Cena. Maybe they would have had Brian in there get crushed in 5 minutes. You know, we'll never know. I think they did what they did with Cena to shock people. You know, he's Superman. He's the 15-time champion. He's been the face of the company for the last 10 years. Brian is none of those things, other than he's a great wrestler who could probably give Brock the best match of his WWE run this time around, or at least the kind of match that Punk gave him last year. So maybe they would have had a more competitive match for that reason, but the end result would have been the same. Brock wins the title in decisive fashion. I still would like to see the match. It would make for a nice comeback story if Brian actually beat him, but he doesn't have to. I'd be fine with Brock winning. The question is, when will Brian be ready to return? How will the fans react to him when he actually does come back? And if they react big, would they put him back in the title picture right away? If so, and he can make it back in time for the Royal Rumble, you could have Brian win the Rumble, which would be poetic after being left out of the match this year and the big uproar from the fans because he didn't come out at number 30, and do Brian versus Brock at WrestleMania. But there's so many different factors that are in play here. You know, the stars, I think, would have to align perfectly for Brian to be healed up by the Rumble and for the fans to still be as hot for him as they were earlier this year. I would love to see it because I think in the end we would get a great match out of it. But I think it's almost like things have to work out a little too perfectly for that to happen. And it also ties into the last guy here, and that's Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns is seemingly on the fast track to the championship, probably on the fast track to wrestle for the title, which would be against Brock, most likely at WrestleMania 31 next year. Much like Brian and Brock, it's a match we've never seen before. Reigns is a lot bigger than Brian. He's more of a badass than Brian, so that match might be more popular to people. I'd love to see either one of them. I don't really have a big preference either way. You'd probably get a better wrestling match if Brian were in there, but you know, Brian and Brock and Reigns would be fine to me. I still think that's the most likely scenario. That's probably the end game here for Lesnar. If Brock gets past Night of Champions with the belt, which he should, then I think they go all the way to Mania with him on top. Roman Reigns is going to be that guy. He's the next big star who's well on his way. He'll already be groomed for the top spot by that point. Maybe it ends up being a Randy Orton, Batista, and Evolution type deal where they have plans for one guy, but the other guy, in this case Dean Ambrose, gets more over than Reigns, and he gets the spot instead. I think there's an outside shot of that happening. Not very likely at all. But Ambrose, who knows? Maybe Ambrose makes it there before Reigns does with the reactions that he's been getting. I'm sure they didn't bank on Ambrose getting over more than Roman Reigns, but he is. You know, if Ambrose makes it there before Reigns does, that's really, I think, going to depend on how stubborn WWE is. If they have a plan and they don't want to deviate from it, it's going to be hard. If Ambrose keeps getting those kinds of reactions, though, I think that he's been getting. If that keeps up, it's going to be hard for them to ignore that. But I do think in the end, they stay the course with Roman Reigns. Hopefully he continues to get better and improve. And you don't know if Brock's going to stay beyond WrestleMania next year. So why not build him up for a newer, younger guy to be the one to tear him down? Someone you can build your company around for years to come, which realistically you can build around any of those three Shield guys. It looks like Roman Reigns is going to be that guy. So why not go all in? Speaking of the Shield, I caught the Shield documentary on the WWE Network, which is up on demand if you missed it. I think it's worth the 55 minutes or so to sit down and watch. William Regal is on there. He's interviewed Gabe Sapolsky, Les Thatcher, who talked about training Dean Ambrose back in the Heartland Wrestling Association days, which was one of the WWE developmental territories at the time. Terry Taylor is interviewed. They told the story of he and Seth Rollins butting heads in developmental because Rollins had the attitude that he was better than everybody else there, which he probably was. And he was frustrated that he wasn't getting called up to the point where Taylor threw his hands up in the air and just told Triple H, look, you got to talk to this guy. Either you talk to him and smooth this over and let him know the way things are, or you got to get rid of him. And Triple H is on there talking about how he and Rollins had a coming to Jesus session where he told him in no uncertain terms, you need to be patient or your ass is out of here. Gabe was on there talking about booking Rollins back when he was Tyler Black in ROH to be the top star in the promotion, but others there did not share that same view, and Sapolsky got fired as the head booker by Kerry Silken, who he didn't mention by name. He only mentioned him as the owner, basically implying that the owner and other people in ROH didn't know what the fuck they were doing. That's basically what he said. And Tyler Black, in fact, did not end up getting that top spot. He did win the belt, but he was never really on top for that long as the top guy in Ring of Honor. I take it he would have been had Gabe not been removed. Just to hear about all of this being talked about on a WWE documentary was just surreal. I mean, they even went into Ambrose's background from his CZW days. They had CZW footage on the WWE Network. And they had really grainy quality footage that they credited to WWNLive.com of Ambrose on the indies. I just thought this whole thing was great. They went into Roman Reigns' background, too, with footage of him playing football and getting drafted but not really making it. So he went to Canada to play. And at that point, he came to a crossroads in his life where he had to make a decision about what he was going to do. You know, am I going to just keep doing this and hope that one day I'm good enough to get back into the NFL? Or is it time that I go do something else? You know, he has a young daughter, and he had to just make a decision. Son of Sika, of the Wild Samoans, wrestling was in his blood, it's in his family tree, and with that daughter to support, he made the decision to pursue wrestling. You know, and I think if they're at all worried about fans eventually turning on Roman Reigns, what they need to do is air this on TV. Not the whole documentary, but air the Roman Reigns portion as part of like a promo package or a vignette on television, because there's no way you could boo this man after seeing this. The whole thing ends with footage of their SummerSlam matches and then some post-match interviews backstage with each guy. It fades out with Dean Ambrose on there saying, the goal from day one of the Shield was to take over the business. So whether we're friends or whether we're enemies, we're going to own the business. And then it ends. If so, the future is in good hands. This is exactly the sort of thing they should be doing more of with this network. It was shot like a special you would see on ESPN or HBO before a big fight. There's no reason they can't be doing monthly specials like this on different guys and, you know, time it to coincide, let's say, with that month's pay-per-view event. The one knock on this I do have is that it did a great job of building up these guys' SummerSlam matches, but it didn't air until after SummerSlam. Like, there's a point in here where they're each talking about their matches, and they show them training in the gym and preparing for it, and, like, it's a day after SummerSlam. So I thought the timing was kind of messed up. They should have aired this at least a few days earlier, because it may have even gotten some people who were on the fence about ordering SummerSlam to subscribe to the network to first see the documentary and then stick around to watch SummerSlam. I mean, if you're already a network subscriber, then you're already in. You know, you're airing the documentary on the network. I mean, in a perfect world, this would have aired on USA, but that's not going to happen. So I just thought the timing was a little odd. But there's so many guys on that roster that we know very little about when it comes to their background and what they went through to get to where they are, what their daily routine is like. They're just a bunch of faces they throw out there for 3 minutes every Monday night. More profile pieces like this, I think, would go a long way to getting people to actually care about guys that most people don't have any real connection to right now. I mean, how many people on the current roster do you honestly feel you have some kind of emotional connection to, meaning you actually give a shit what they do? You actually give a shit if they win or lose? How many people? A lot of you guys don't even watch the shows anymore. You just keep in touch with it through this podcast. That's a problem. So I think stuff like this, if they do it a little more often, could be a real big help. Raw from this past Monday night was live from Las Vegas, Nevada. The good, the bad, and the ugly that we'll go through here. Not a lot of ugly. I thought overall this was a pretty good show. The Scratch logo is officially dead. The big gold belt has been retired again for now. And we have a new, old WWE Championship belt. I knew we were getting the same belt, just with a different logo. But I can see why some people who don't follow that sort of news online would feel let down when Triple H and Stephanie made this big hoopla about this championship title ceremony, and they had the towel over the belt or whatever, the bag over the belt, and they built it up as this big moment. And they do the big reveal, and it's basically the same belt as before. They really should have just did what Vince did on that Raw, where Austin drove the Zamboni into the building. They had the old Winged Eagle belt in this clear glass case in the middle of the ring, ready to be presented to the new champion. It was right there, clear as day, what the belt looked like, and it was no big surprise. That way it wouldn't have been such a big letdown, I guess, for those people. But in any event, the new logo and the USA Network logo switched places on my screen. My OCD was kicking in big time. That was weird enough. But we also had no John Cena. And Ryback was the most over guy on the show. So I think it's safe to say this was a pretty weird show this week. Opening segment with Stephanie. She came out doing the yes chant. She was wearing a Steph shirt. All proceeds for which, by the way, go to Connor's Cure, which is the fund that was set up in honor of Connor the Crusher, who was the kid that Daniel Bryan met before he died. He's actually in the opening of the show now, by the way, in the opening signature, which is pretty cool. They haven't even put Hulk Hogan back in the opening signature, so I guess Connor got his spot. She calls out Nikki Bella, cuts a full heel promo on her sister, who she turned on at SummerSlam. She was very much like Owen Hart out here during this segment, only minus the wrestling ability. It was always about Brie growing up. You could just replace Brie with Brett. This is almost the same storyline. Nikki mocked Brian. That brought out Brie, who, instead of going after her sister for her betrayal at SummerSlam, she tried to plead with her that, "I forgive you. I forgive you." And this only pissed off Nikki Bella, who couldn't believe that Brie came out to say, "Oh, I forgive you for what you did." So this angered Nikki, who slapped the shit out of Brie. It was actually a hell of a slap. And with that, Brie ran off crying. This seems to set up a Brie versus Nikki match at Night of Champions. They could do another match with Stephanie and have Brie win, then set up a match between the sisters maybe at the next show. But I have less than zero interest. I have sub-zero interest in seeing Nikki versus Brie. Nor do I think anybody who is a fan of them, like anybody who watches Total Divas, for example, wants to see the two of them fighting. It's Matt Hardy versus Jeff Hardy all over again. Nobody wanted to see them fight. They had one match with Lita as the special referee that died a death. And then they had another feud later on that led to a WrestleMania match, and that didn't get over either. Sometimes people just don't want to see two people fighting. They only want to see them together as friends, together as partners. You know, Brett versus Owen, that worked. Matt versus Jeff did not work. I don't think Nikki versus Brie is going to work. But that's, you know, at least with Matt and Jeff, you knew you had the chance to have a great wrestling match. Here, you have no chance. There is no chance in hell that these two are going to go out there and have a great wrestling match. It's just one giant angle. But I have to say this, though. Nikki was not terrible here. You know, neither one of them can act worth a lick, but Nikki at least showed some fire here when she got angry at Brie. That's the best I could say about this segment. Mark Henry and Big Show beat Harper and Rowan of the Wyatt family. Henry pinned Rowan. KO punch, followed by a World's Strongest Slam. Someone emailed me suggesting the name White Chocolate as a team name. I guess White, because that's Big Show's last name, Paul White. Very clever. Very clever. Meanwhile, the Wyatts continue their losing ways. Renee Young interviewed Seth Rollins about his SummerSlam victory when suddenly he had a bucket of ice water dumped on his head. They pan over to show Dean Ambrose standing there with this confused look on his face. He can't understand why Rollins is so upset. He says, "What? It's for charity." Before launching the bucket right into Rollins' face. And mind you, he was only standing like 2 feet in front of the guy. Ambrose jumps on Rollins. Officials break him up. Rollins is just exasperated. He goes into Triple H's office. He demands this has to end. This just has to end. He's not going to stop. Triple H says, "I agree. It will end tonight. You're going to be wrestling Dean Ambrose, and the stipulation will be decided by the fans." And the choices that we were given for this main event match were no holds barred, false count anywhere, or no disqualification. Yes, option A and option C, basically the same exact match. Although, in WWE, apparently when there's a no DQ match, you can still be counted out, which is completely stupid. So maybe that's their out here. It's basically the same fucking match. They knew exactly what match they wanted to do. It's the reason why these polls are meaningless, and you really shouldn't bother voting. I don't ever tell people, don't vote. I feel like people should always vote. If you have the right to vote, whether it's a mayoral election, governor, president, senator, whatever, always exercise your right to vote, even if the options you're choosing from the lesser of two evils. When it comes to stupid bullshit polls like this on the WWE app, don't vote, people. Don't waste your time. Natalya beat Paige 1 minute 38 seconds, according to the Divas stopwatch, so we are regressing here. And we really are. This is not a one-week aberration. We had reached a point where the Divas matches had actually grown since I started doing this Divas stopwatch gimmick. Because I started it because we were literally week after week having a match 30 seconds, 1 minute, a minute and 20 seconds. And that was the average length of a Divas match. And slowly it went up. It went up to 3 minutes and then four. And it was even averaging around 4 minutes and maybe sometimes between four and five. But now we've regressed so much that even on pay-per-view, where they would actually sometimes give the women closer to 10 minutes, maybe even 6 or 7, you know, Paige and AJ from SummerSlam wasn't even 5 minutes, and now here we are on this show, a minute and 38 seconds. Natalya wins with a distraction roll-up. After AJ's music hit, she came skipping down to the ring. After the match, AJ said she was dedicating her whole life to Paige. "She loves Paige. I love you," she said. Some lesbian overtones here. Basically, they're trying to out-crazy each other. That's the story. She went to go shake Paige's hand, but Paige bailed. Natalya pinned the Divas champion. And then on SmackDown, she got Paige to tap out to the sharpshooter after AJ interfered again. So that gives Natalya and Eva Marie multiple wins over the Divas champion. So in theory, there should be a four-way match at Night of Champions for the title. By no means do I need to see Eva Marie challenging for the Divas title, but she deserves it every bit as much as Natalya does. Now, are they going to get it? Are they going to make that match? Who knows? They do this shit all the time where they have these meaningless matches that are not followed up on. We could very easily just get AJ versus Paige again at Night of Champions. I don't know what their plan is, but with that being said, I have a challenge for WWE, and I hope somebody there is listening to this, because I am throwing down the gauntlet right now. From now on, every time you book a distraction roll-up finish on TV, which is the most overused, lazy finish in WWE today, how about donating $250 to your foundation of choice? ALS research is popular right now with these ice bucket challenges. Make a donation to the ALS Association. Make a donation to Connor's Cure, which WWE has been very supportive of, and they should be applauded for that. I mentioned earlier, all proceeds from the sale of Stephanie McMahon's new t-shirt are going to Connor's Cure, which is great. Whatever charity you choose, Make a $250 donation every time you insist on using that finish. And hell, make it retroactive to the beginning of 2014 while you're at it. You will wipe out ALS in no time from those donations alone. That would at least make these finishes a little less aggravating if we all knew it was for a good cause. They do that in baseball sometimes. Every time so-and-so hits a home run, X amount of money is donated to a certain cause. WWE already does a lot of philanthropy. But if they insist on doing these lame finishes, then at least make it worthwhile. That's my challenge to WWE, should they choose to accept it. No John Cena on the show this past week. He'll be back on TV this Monday to cut a promo. I wish they would hold him out until the next pay-per-view. Just show him, like, training, really, like, hardcore, getting ready for this next match. But I should know better than to think that they would keep Cena off TV for more than a week. I know I'm asking for too much. Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman, on the other hand, they were on the show, and Heyman somehow managed to top himself yet again on the microphone. Heyman said that he's been in this business since he was 14 years old, and he has never seen a superstar take an ass-kicking the way that John Cena did at SummerSlam. And not just a superstar, but a top superstar of this generation. He said The Rock was on top for 3, maybe 3.5 years. Steve Austin was on top for 4, maybe 4.5 years. Yet John Cena has been on top for 10 straight years. Any other guy would have given up, but he didn't. He said his own kids are John Cena fans, which really pisses him off. That got a laugh out of the audience. Reminded me of that segment on Raw with Eddie Guerrero and The Rock. And Eddie is talking about how his kids idolize their father, but one day he walked into their room and he saw a poster of The Rock on the wall. And Eddie freaked out and he ripped the poster down. It was a hilarious promo. Cena earned Heyman's respect. That was kind of the message he was trying to convey here in this promo. He even said he would have been proud to make him a Paul Heyman guy back in the day. He put John Cena over like a champ here because that's what you do. You talk about how great the guy is, which in turn makes your guy look that much better for beating him and taking his title. You don't belittle the guy like he's nothing and make your own guy look like a chump, which other champions have done if you go back many years after they vanquish their opponent and they come out on TV, maybe even before the match, they come out and they talk about how much the other guy sucks, or he's a joke, or he doesn't belong in the main event, he doesn't deserve to be a champion, all this kind of nonsense, and it does nothing to make the other guy stand out like a worthy challenger. It's so counterproductive. It's nice to see that they finally have this formula down the correct way, where you send the guy out there, and instead of just talking about how much John Cena is shit, Paul Heyman goes out there and says, no, in fact, John Cena is not shit. John Cena is the number one guy in this company. He's a guy that I would have been proud to manage back in the day, but guess what? I don't manage him because I manage somebody better than him. And as for Lesnar, he said nothing, but he still made the entire segment by winking at the camera right before they cut away. It was so perfect and just such a dick move. Nobody is better at being a dick than Brock Lesnar. And who, look, maybe he's like that in real life. You hear stories of people who have encountered him. He doesn't like people. I've never met him, so I don't know. I could definitely believe that in real life, Brock Lesnar, he probably is a jerk to a lot of people. He probably is a dick. Nobody is a dick better on this roster than Brock Lesnar. I just thought this was great. Second best thing on the entire show after the main event, this segment was Miz vs. Dolph Ziggler, non-title rematch from SummerSlam. Story here was Ziggler injuring his knee, Miz working it over, including a figure four leg lock spot. Dolph escaped to the outside. He could not make it back inside in time. He got counted out, so Miz wins. He was not happy. He attacked Ziggler when the match was over, but Dolph caught him with the zigzag out of nowhere, left him laying. So they appear to be headed for a rematch at Night of Champions, where I presume Miz gets his belt back. Hey, Cesaro, got a win. About time. He pinned Jack Swagger with the neutralizer. After the match, Bo Dallas came out, said that Jack lost his manager, which is not a good sign for Zeb. He lost his self-respect. Now he lost his dignity. But fear not. He could get it all back. All he has to do is believe. Roman Reigns, Rob Van Dam, Sheamus beat Randy Orton and Rybacksel in a pretty fun six-man tag team match. This turned into a real good match there at the end. Ryback was the most over guy in this match. He was the most over guy, maybe neck and neck with Ambrose on the entire show, because they were in Las Vegas. They were in Sin City, Ryback's hometown. So Orton's in the ring, and all he hears are chants for Ryback and feed me more became a thing again for one night at least. And Randy Orton's doing the whole cupping, the Hulk Hogan cupping of the year thing. He's like, you want him? All right, you got him. And he tagged in Ryback, and he ran wild for a little bit, although Ryback was in the ring for literally all of 2 or 3 minutes. RVD got the pin for his team on Curtis Axel. Interesting they would give Van Damme the pin here and not Roman Reigns, but I guess it set up the RVD-Orton match on SmackDown, where Orton obliterated him as a way to send a message to Roman Reigns and keep their feud going. It looks like they may be doing an Orton-Reigns rematch instead of going with Reigns and Triple H, which I figured would be the big match they would want on that September show. It certainly doesn't look that way right now. Goldust and Stardust beat the Usos, non-title match. Stardust got the surprise pin out of nowhere, so I guess that sets them up to challenge for the titles next. The Wyatts just absolutely do not deserve another shot after all of those losses. And now Mark Henry appears to be doing something with Rusev, which I think has a better chance of ending up as a match on the next pay-per-view than anything with Henry and Big Show. So it would certainly seem like Goldust and Stardust would be in line for a shot at the next pay-per-view. Up next was the Mark Henry-Rusev angle, where Mark showed a lot of fire in defending his country and then laid out Rusev with the World's Strongest Slam. He then high-fived all of the announcers at ringside like this was some great accomplishment. He should have laid all three of them out with the World's Strongest Slam. Now that would have been an accomplishment worth getting excited over. Rollins vs. Ambrose, main event, Falls Count Anywhere match, which is the stip that won the fan poll. Awesome, awesome match. I love this. Even better than their SummerSlam match. Easily the best thing on the entire show here on Monday. And I love that they got the main event spot, even if the ratings did not reflect that love. I love that they gave these guys a chance to go out there and end the show, and I thought they tore the house down. I love that clothesline spot where Ambrose does the old Nigel McGuinness bounce out of the ropes deal into a lariat, turns Rollins inside out, sells it like a champ. Then comes Dirty Deeds. Ambrose seemingly has the match won, but Kane comes out, yanks him out of the ring, choke slams him on the announce desk. With the crowd heat for that near fall, for that brief moment, it reminded me of a hot title match on Raw during the Attitude Era, where Steve Austin would have the match won, but one of the heels, like one of McMahon's henchmen, would yank the referee out before the three, and the place would just go nuts. People were just losing their minds. We kind of had a moment like that there. It didn't last too long, but for that moment, it felt like a throwback to those days. That's how hot the people were for this. Kane and Rollins conspired together after the match to take Ambrose out for good. You saw what happened. They did the deal with the styrofoam cinder blocks, which I thought was lame when Scott Hall used it on Steve Austin's knee leading up to WrestleMania 18, and I thought it was just as lame here. But they had to do something to get Ambrose off TV for a while to film his movie. Somehow this resulted in Rollins being declared the winner of the match. I know it was false count anywhere, but I don't remember him pinning Ambrose, I guess because maybe he was unable to continue. They made it a forfeit. I don't know. They're doing an angle on the website where Ambrose apparently escaped from the hospital after the show. He is now on the loose, which is pretty cool. They can have Rollins acting scared and on edge for the next several weeks until Ambrose surprise ambushes him when he's ready to return. Hopefully that sets up a Hell in a Cell match between them in October. Unless Ambrose can come back in time for Night of Champions, I guess it's possible. But I'm more looking forward to the possibility of a Hell in a Cell match, to be honest with you. That's what the Hell in a Cell stip should be used for. To blow off a feud like Ambrose versus Rollins, it was tailor-made for that stipulation. And that was Raw. I still think that we need to give Roman Reigns a chance, because a lot of people are jumping on the guy for no good reason. I think they're just way too impatient. But, boy, after this show and this main event, it's obvious to me they already have something big in Ambrose. Like with Reigns, they have something in him already, and the end goal is for him to be really big. And I think they're going to get there. It's just going to take a little bit longer. It's going to take some months before they get there. With Ambrose, he's already there. You know, and I don't know if they realize it or not. Maybe they do, and they don't care because it's not part of the plan. But they've got something big in this guy. They obviously know what they have with him because they wouldn't have given him a movie role, you know, if they didn't have other things planned for him. But do they act on it? I kind of touched on this a little bit earlier when I was running off the list of possible challengers for Brock Lesnar during his title run and how I think the end game is Roman Reigns at WrestleMania next year. But would they call an audible here and shift Ambrose into that spot if he can maintain that popularity and continue to get better and get over even more and do Lesnar versus Ambrose at some point? I don't know. That's one of the questions I think that we should watch for over the next several months. Do they stall this guy's momentum because it's not part of the plan? Or do they change course maybe if Reigns is not getting over at the level they had hoped, if the people finally turn on the guy or he just doesn't improve from where he's already at and they decide, you know what, this guy's more polished, let's go with Ambrose. Very curious to see where Ambrose is 6 months from now. This Monday night, they're going to open the show with a Hall of Fame forum, talking about the John Cena versus Brock Lesnar rematch coming up in Night of Champions. They're advertising Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, and Shawn Michaels as being in the ring when the show opens on Monday night, so just be aware of that. Also, I have to say congratulations to Tom Phillips, who has been promoted to the lead play-by-play announcer slash host of SmackDown on Friday nights. Michael Cole and JBL will still be on commentary, but they're being relegated to what they're calling analysts. So they'll be there doing announcing with Phillips, but Phillips is going to be the face of the show. He'll be the primary play-by-play guy, I guess even more so than Cole. And that's a big promotion for him. They've been grooming him on NXT for a while. I think he's also been doing Superstars maybe, or Main Event, one of them. So now he gets to make it to the big time. And speaking of SmackDown, it appears that SmackDown's move to Thursdays has been confirmed by Sci-Fi on their own website. It is on the Sci-Fi calendar. Thursday, October 2nd is the first Thursday night listing for SmackDown. It's right there on their website, unless they've already taken it down by the time you hear this. But I'm looking at it right now with my own two eyes, so that appears to be all the confirmation that we need, that SmackDown is moving to Thursdays, and October 2nd is likely the debut for them on that date. NXT first aired at 4 o'clock Eastern this past week. I'm not sure if that's the new time or just a one-week thing, but I'm watching it in its normal time because, really, who the hell is home at 4 o'clock on a Thursday to watch this? I mean, come on. Open with a semifinal match in the NXT Tag Team Title Tournament. The Vaudevillains against Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy. Big fans of Kaz and Enzo. Not so much the Vaudevillains, but the Vaudevillains got the win. They got the win with their move. That's a wrap. It's the rolling senton into a swanton bomb combo. Pinned Enzo for the win. After the match, the Legionnaires hit the ring. They shaved off part of Enzo Amore's beard. That was a heinous atrocity here on NXT. I'm surprised we didn't get that line about how his dignity was being raped that Vince McMahon said when Andre the Giant had his hair cut off all those years ago. So they are continuing the feud with Kaz and Enzo and the Frenchman. At least the Frenchman didn't cost them the match. It was a clean win for the Vaudevillains, so I give them points on that. Triple H, he came out for a special announcement that I think most of us probably already saw because they posted it on their YouTube channel right after the tapings a few weeks ago. But he announced that they are having a second live special September 11th on the WWE Network, and it will be TakeOver. TakeOver 2, Electric Boogaloo. And they are also hyping an announcement for a new NXT general manager this upcoming Thursday, so that should be interesting to see who they choose. Tyler Breeze is backstage, very upset at Tyson Kidd for costing him the NXT title the week before. He's here tonight to show Tyson why he is not just a pretty face, so we are getting a rare heel versus heel match on this show that I was looking forward to. Tyson Kidd against Tyler Breeze. They had a match. They went back and forth for a couple of minutes. And all of a sudden, Tyler Breeze said, you know what? Fuck this shit. I'm out of here. And he left. He took a powder and he got counted out. And I thought that was a really, really lame finish. I'm a big Tyler Breeze fan. I'm a big fan of what they've been doing with the character and having him show some more fire. And I get that he's a heel. Sometimes even a chicken shit heel, although not all the time. They flip-flop sometimes. Sometimes he'll be a chicken shit heel, and then other times he'll go face-to-face with you, and he'll stand toe-to-toe, and I guess this was not one of those nights because he bailed. And the reason I didn't like this, I know he's a heel, but the reason I didn't like this is he has a reason to be legitimately upset with Tyson Kidd Tyson Tyler, getting confused here. But he's got a legitimate gripe. The guy cost him the title. He could have walked out the new champion last week were it not for this guy. And even in the promo, you know, before the match, I'm going to show him why I'm not just a pretty face. Basically, I'm going to show him why I'm not just a gimmick. And he goes out there and he leaves like a chicken shit. I didn't like that finish. I didn't like that finish at all. And then later on backstage, they had a quick interview with Tyler Breeze. They caught him in the hallway. They kind of did the old TMZ ambush on him. And he said, look, I don't get what the big deal is. Me and Tyson, we got no beef. We got no beef. I'm more concerned about the big announcement next week regarding the NXT Championship. Meanwhile, there was no mention before this of there being a big announcement. This is the first that we're learning of this, is through Tyler Breeze talking about this as though we're all supposed to know. So I presume next week we will find out what the title match is for the TakeOver special. My guess is a four-way with Adrian Neville, Sami Zayn, Tyson Kidd, and Tyler Breeze, which has match of the year written all over it if they actually give these guys time to go out there and do what they do best. So I guess we'll find out next week what that match is. Charlotte, NXT Women's Champion, one-on-one with Becky Lynch. Pretty standard match. You know, Charlotte is very good, considering that she hasn't been doing this for very long. She has come a long way. She's a perfectly fine professional wrestler. I haven't seen enough of Becky Lynch. You know, these have been pretty short matches. I haven't seen enough of her to really form an opinion. I know she's got a lot of fans out there who are really big into her, and they're happy to see her getting her big break finally in WWE. All I can say is I've seen nothing outstanding from this woman. So hopefully as time goes on, she'll have longer matches and we'll be able to see what she's really got up her sleeve, because this to me was just your standard run-of-the-mill Divas match, and Charlotte got the win in the end with her bow down to the Queen Cutter. Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy came back out onto the ramp, very upset about being attacked by the Frenchman earlier in the show, and Enzo challenged Sylvester Lefort to a hair-versus-hair match at TakeOver. Hopefully that'll be the blow-off for the feud. And hopefully he doesn't lose the rest of his beard. Can't picture Enzo without it. Mojo Rawley pinned Steve Cutler. Mojo back to his winning ways here with a win over an enhancement guy who nobody has ever seen before. Speaking of this Steve Cutler guy, one of you posted on Facebook multiple images of what this guy looks like. This is before I had watched NXT, because I actually didn't watch it until Saturday this week. So you guys had already seen it. And you posted pictures of this guy, Steve Cutler, online, like small photos, claiming that he bore a striking resemblance to yours truly, that this guy was like a dead ringer for me. And I'm looking at it, I'm going, I don't know if I really see it. Maybe, you know, in the upper right-hand corner, maybe that image a little bit. So I watched the show, and sure as shit, it was kind of scary, to be perfectly honest with you. There is something about the guy, there's something about his face, not that we're identical twins or anything like that, but yeah, I kind of do see it. I don't know what it is, but there is a similarity there. Hopefully if I ever set foot in the ring, I would fare better than he did, because he got squashed here by Mojo Rawley. Mojo then got on the mic when the match was over. We got our first serious promo, our first angry promo. Mojo's always out there, he's smiling, he's slapping hands with the fans, he's hyped, right? You gotta stay hyped. I don't get hyped, I stay hype. That's his expression. Well, here, he was not hyped. He was angry, and he spoke very low. And I think, I didn't write it down, but I think he said something to the effect of, you always see me smile, but now there's no smile on my face, or something like that. Meanwhile, throughout the whole promo, the crowd was chanting Bull. They were chanting for Bull Dempsey. So we all know who's going to be the babyface in that feud. Main event was another semifinal match in the NXT Tag Team Championship Contenders Tournament. Kalisto and Sin Cara against Sami Zayn and Adam Rose. This is the match that's worth going out of your way to watch this week. Very good match. And with Adam Rose, we saw a lot of, I think, Leo Kruger in his demeanor, in his offense here. They were almost working as the heels in this match against the babyface Kalisto and Sin Cara. Even Sami Zayn a little bit, but more so, I noticed it with Adam Rose. I saw a lot of Leo Kruger and Adam Rose this week, and that spinebuster is among the best that anybody has in the entire company. You know, it's too bad the guy's not more over than he is, because he throws probably the best spinebuster in all of WWE right now. Like, when he hits it, it's almost like that should be his finishing move. It's hard to accept the spinebuster as a finish, but he hits it so well with such force that I almost feel like he could use that as a finisher if he wanted to. It probably would be better than his party foul, which is more or less the same move that Dean Ambrose uses. It's the same thing as Dean Ambrose's Dirty Deeds. So they had a match, and my favorite part of the whole match, it was a really good match. Sin Cara looked good. Kalisto looked great. This is the best he's looked, I think, since the singles match with Tyler Breeze that they had, which was already a few months ago. It's probably been forgotten by most people. But this is the best that he's looked. And there was a sequence early in the match when Kalisto was in there with Sami Zayn. And somebody online created an animated GIF that was sent to me. And I'll try to remember to post this on Twitter after I'm done recording here. I have it open right now. And I'm looking at it. And I'm looking at it now because there was no adequate way for me to write a description of what this move was. It was this great sequence where Kalisto comes off the ropes. It almost looks like he's going into a flip, like the old Tajiri flip into a, you know, springboard elbow or whatever. But he doesn't allow his body to go all the way over. He actually kind of pauses himself, and instead he pushes back onto his feet, does another flip, grabs Zayn with his legs by the head, flips him over for like a Hurricane Rana type move. Then he does an immediate nip up to his feet and goes for the pin. And I just did a poor job of describing that. So I'll try to post the GIF, and if not, just go on the network and watch NXT for no other reason for this match and this spot. It was great. And it's another sign that, you know, Kalisto is a guy who's got a lot of offense and a lot of moves that either he hasn't used yet, he wants to save it, or maybe they don't let him use some of his moves. They tell these guys to slow down and focus on storytelling and psychology, and that's all well and good. But a lot of these guys, Adrian Neville is another one. I mean, if you think he's great, I've seen matches of his, and I'm sure a lot of you guys have as well. You know exactly what I'm talking about. He can do so much more. It's scary the amount of stuff that he can do that either he doesn't want to do or they tell him not to do. And so this is the first real offensive flurry like this that we've seen from Kalisto, and it was awesome. And it makes me wonder, you know, if they make it to the live special on September 11th, or if they're, you know, if that's the show, maybe if they win where they're wrestling the Ascension for the belts, what we might see from this guy, what he might be holding out on us for, maybe for a big show like that. So this was just great. And in the end, Sin Cara and Kalisto got the win. Got the pin on Adam Rose. And so they advance in the tournament. Adam Rose and Sami Zayn are eliminated. Can't say that I'm enamored with another Sami Zayn loss. He did have a win, I think, over Tyson Kidd, that submission move that he used on him a few weeks ago. But it just feels like he loses way more than he wins. I answered a mailbag question directly that somebody sent me, and I said, look, yes, if it were up to me, I wouldn't have him losing as much, especially since he's the most over guy on NXT. He's so beloved. But it doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is once he makes it to TV, once he makes it to the main roster, if they have him losing like this every single week, that's when I would get worried. Right now, it's just NXT. Wins and losses, they matter, but to a point. I wouldn't get freaked out about it. The fact that he's even in the mix right now, you know, he was in the tournament, but he's going to seemingly be in the title picture heading into TakeOver, is reason enough to be happy. At least he's going to be seemingly in the championship mix, which is exactly where he should be. Here, this was not his night. At least he didn't take the losing fall. And so Kalisto and Sin Cara move on. Good show overall. I enjoyed it. If you missed it, check it out. Thank you guys for taking time out of your day to listen to The Sound Off. I get questions from people asking, how can I support the podcast? Well, the best way to support the show is simple. Just keep listening each and every week. Keep spreading the word about it to friends and family and retweet or share links to the episodes on Twitter and Facebook. But beyond that, you can contribute by making a PayPal donation or by signing up for a free 30-day trial of the Audible.com service. Making a PayPal donation is simple. Just log on to thesolemonster.com and you'll see the PayPal donation box on the right-hand side of the page. Enter whatever amount you'd like and click the Make a Donation button. That's it. Or sign up for a free Audible trial by entering our custom URL, audibletrial.com/solemonster. From there, you can sign up free for 30 days, which helps us out. You get one free audiobook as part of your trial that you get to keep no matter what. You can browse through their library of over 150,000 titles. Listen to your books at home, on the commute to work, at the gym, whenever, wherever. Sign up at audibletrial.com/solemonster or visit thesolemonster.com to make a donation right now. And thank you for supporting The Sound Off. It looks like TNA is getting a stay of execution until the end of the year. Dixie Carter put the following statement out this past week. Impact Wrestling will remain a vital part of Spike TV's programming on Wednesday nights through the end of the year. Negotiations remain ongoing beyond this time frame. For what it's worth, TMZ, which broke the original story about Impact being canceled by Spike, they insist that, according to their sources, nothing has changed, and the decision not to renew was made a long time ago. So they're sticking to their story. They're not retracting it. They're not apologizing for it. They're saying, nope, it's true. Spike already made the call a long time ago. They are not bringing back Impact. And what we're seeing here is just them being nice. It's posturing to give TNA more time to negotiate a deal with another television station. So that's the TMZ version of events. I see rumors popping up online here. I don't know where it's coming from that Impact may already have a new home. Obviously, negotiations are still ongoing, but there may be another place for them to go once it's made official that Spike has, in fact, decided not to renew them. Some people throwing WGN, which is the big superstation out of Chicago. WGN does not have a lot of penetration, for example, here in New York. I don't think on Cablevision, which is my provider, I don't think we have WGN. I don't know about the people who have Time Warner Cable. So if they get on WGN, it keeps them alive. It's another place for them to air Impact, but it's a terrible place for them to go. Any place that they don't have national distribution on a major national cable channel like Spike is not good news for TNA. It's good news in that, okay, it keeps them alive for a while longer, but how much longer? How much money could they possibly get from a WGN, if that's true? And it's not. Right now, that's just 100% rumor. People are throwing around the WGN name. To me, yeah, it keeps them alive. It's better than nothing. But, you know, if the fate of your company is dictated by, well, it's better than nothing, then guess what? You're in a pretty bad situation. But according to Spike, they're going to keep Impact on the air until the end of the year. So Impact has a few more months yet to go. The other big story that I broke is part of the Sound Off Extra video I did when I did my SummerSlam review on YouTube because the news had just broken, was Bully Ray leaving TNA. And as I mentioned on that video, Bully Ray had a locker room meeting at the TNA house show last Sunday, Hagerstown, Maryland, and he informed the crew that that was going to be his last night with the company and he likely would not be back, so he wanted to say his goodbyes. And it caught everybody off guard. Everybody was shocked. Of all the people that you would expect to hear that from, Bully Ray was not that person. Nobody knew anything about it. Nobody knew his deal was about to be up. Nobody knew he was in negotiations for a new deal with TNA. He kept it very close to the vest. I mean, maybe Devon knew or, you know, people close to him, but that's it. So it caught everybody off guard. They've been, you know, negotiating, but the two sides have yet to come to terms on a new deal. What we've learned since then is that Bully's contract reportedly expires this weekend. So as I am recording this, his contract is either done or it will be in a matter of hours. And he will at that point be free to negotiate with whoever he wants and potentially go wherever he wants to go if they'll have him. So that opens up the questions to, is he going to go back to WWE? Could he end up in Ring of Honor? Is he going to go to Japan? You know, Bully, I think the Dudleys have wrestled in Japan before, and there are certainly a lot of Americans right now who are tearing it up in New Japan. AJ Styles is one of them. I don't expect Bully Ray to be working matches at the caliber that AJ Styles is, but they've got Doc Gallows and Carl Anderson, and you know what? I could see Bully Ray by himself, maybe not with Devon, going over there and being perfectly fine as this American, heel bully character who comes in and just beats up people. And I could see Bully Ray even fitting into a group like the Bullet Club. I wouldn't have put Jeff Jarrett in the Bullet Club. I wish they wouldn't have done that. A guy like Bully, I could have seen him fitting in there. It's just a matter of whether or not they want him. Do they feel like they already have enough Americans? We don't want to bring over every single American who needs a job. So I don't know how realistic that is. The bigger question is WWE. Is there value in one last Bully Ray WWE run as a singles? Okay, he was singles in WWE for a very brief period of time. So brief that most people probably won't even remember it. He didn't really do anything of note. He had one title match on Raw, I think, with Triple H and lost, of course, as everybody did back then. And then they put the Dudleys back together when they realized how much they messed up. They never should have broken them up in the first place. So him coming to WWE as a big-time singles heel, I guess he could be a babyface. I think he's a born, natural heel. And if they ever did bring him in, it probably would be as a heel. Could that work? I say yes. I know he's no spring chicken. I know he's, you know, 40-something years old. But I do think there's value in bringing in Bully Ray as a top act or even upper mid-card to top act heel in the company. I think there's value in a John Cena versus Bully Ray feud. If John Cena doesn't get the belt back from Brock Lesnar, which he should, he's going to need people to feud with. Rusev is a guy who they're seemingly grooming for Cena. So Cena versus Rusev may not be a feud that excites you. It doesn't excite me either. But it's a fresh match. They could do that. John Cena versus Bully Ray. You could easily get two or three pay-per-view matches out of it, and it gives John Cena something to do, and it just works. Because Bully Ray is a bully. It's in his name. That's his gimmick. That's his character. John Cena, the big, you know, baby face of PG, going up against a guy like Bully Ray just seems like a natural feud. Now, of course, Bully Ray would not be able to do or say some of the things that he got latitude with in TNA. He absolutely would not be able to get away with a lot of that in WWE. But at the end of the day, I mean, what is he really saying and what is he really doing on Impact that's so abhorrent? Is he going out there and dropping F-bombs? Is he going out there and using a lot of sexual, you know, innuendos and stuff like that? Not really. So I think it could work. I think it could work. And it's just a guy for a John Cena to work with. You could put Bully against a lot of different people. You could do Bully if you really wanted to, I suppose. They could initially bring him in as a babyface and feud him with Brock Lesnar. I probably should have put his name on that list I did earlier. But if they needed a B-show pay-per-view opponent for Brock, and Brock was game to do two or three matches between now and next year's Mania, Bully Ray comes in, goes up against Brock as a babyface, two tough bulls going head-to-head. Of course, Brock wins. And then after that, you could do the heel turn, and then Bully can feud with Cena. He could eventually feud with a guy like Daniel Bryan. He could feud with a lot of different guys. Roman Reigns, Dean Ambrose. I mean, there's any number of guys he could work with. So yeah, I do think there is value in one last run for Bully in WWE as a singles. Do they share that same point of view? My sense is no, they don't. I don't think he left on the best of terms. They probably look at his age as being a big factor against him. So I actually don't see WWE having much interest in bringing Bully Ray in once he officially becomes available, which by the time you listen to this, he probably will be. And that's too bad. And as I said in the video when I first, you know, talked about that that news story, it's a disaster for TNA. I mean, forget the public perception image, because TNA's perception has never been lower than it is right now. It can't possibly go any lower. You could drill holes into the ground and it wouldn't go any lower. But, you know, Bully is involved in everything right now. I mean, he has been the face of these Manhattan Center tapings as the New York guy. They built everything around him. He was the one who put Dixie Carter through a table. It's like Steve Austin and Vince McMahon. Austin was the one who stuttered McMahon, and that's an iconic moment in WWE history. TNA has built this table bump up to be something on that level. Of course, it's not, but that's the closest thing they have to, you know, boss versus employee feud. Boss takes bump from employee, and Bully is that guy. And now he's also part of this big tag team series with the Wolves and the Hardys with the belts on the line. He and D-Von are being inducted into the TNA Hall of Fame in October in Japan as part of Bound for Glory. Now you're faced with the possibility that unless he and TNA come to a last-minute agreement, which they could, they may still be negotiating even as we speak. If that doesn't happen, though, and I assume it just boils down to money, now he probably won't appear at the Hall of Fame. How are you going to induct, you know, Team 3D into the Hall of Fame without Bully Ray being there? Would he agree to come in just for that one appearance? I don't know. But that, his involvement in the tag team stuff right now, with Davey Richards' leg being broken, he may not be able to make it back in time to have the final match of the series. And so you can't even say, well, you could just put the belts on the Dudleys so they go into the Hall of Fame as the champions and then take the belts off them. It's awfully hard to do if you're missing one half of Team 3D. It's almost like the Hardys may end up with the belts by default if Davey Richards can't be back by the end of September. Apparently he's claiming he will be. 4 to 6 weeks, he'll be good to go. That's all well and good. It's great to be optimistic, but he broke his freaking leg. You can't predict how long you're going to be out for. It's just a disaster for TNA. Their first show on Wednesday night, not a disaster. Pretty good show overall, although I have to say I was kind of bored watching this show. I think it had a lot to do with the fact that I was at these tapings, so I already know what happened. I saw it the first time. And I don't really want to spend too much time on the results here because I already did a few weeks ago. I went through all of these results on the Sound Off back when I came back from the taping, so I don't feel the need to go into too much detail here. If you want to go back and hear what I thought about it, go back and listen. I forgot the episode. But just to give you the quick results, Bram beat Abyss, Stairway to Janus match, very bloody, brutal affair, lots of weapons, barbed wire, blood, thumbtacks. If you're into that kind of stuff, you loved it. If you're not, you were probably repulsed by it. These guys are just slicing themselves open for no good reason, really, for TNA. I don't think I would be willing to put my body through that for TNA. EC3 was out there with Rockstar Spud, Rhino. EC3 turned on Rhino, said, "You're the one responsible for Aunt Dixie going through a table." Rhino did a quick babyface turn and said, "You better watch your mouth or I'm going to kick your ass." And in fact, the opposite happened. EC3 attacked Rhino. Rhino looked like a bitch. And in the end, EC3 looked like a tough guy, as tough as we've ever seen him. So his character has come far from what it was at the very beginning, if you remember. He was kind of a pussy. He was wrestling a bunch of nobodies every week. He wouldn't accept any real competition. Finally, he did. And I think TNA has actually done a very good job over time of building EC3 up as, still a douchebag. He's a heel. He's supposed to be hated. But he doesn't go running scared. You know, he faces things head on. He's not the chicken shit heel who runs away. And I like that. Even Spud, when the segment was over, Spud got shoved down by EC3 in a fit of rage, and Spud looked terrified of this guy. So this really made EC3 look strong. Of course, it made Rhino look like a bitch, and that's fine. Because Rhino is only in temporarily. I don't foresee him being around much longer. He's the, quote, old guy. He's the old guard. They should be getting guys over like EC3. And that's what they did here. Samoa Joe and Low-Ki for the X Division title. Best match on the entire show. This was a really good match, very stiff. Joe, his chest looked like hamburger meat. It looked like lots of burst blood vessels on his chest from all the chops from Low-Ki, but in the end, he got his revenge, and Joe retains the title with a muscle buster. Mr. Anderson beat Sam Shaw in an I Quit match that absolutely nobody cared about. Hardys, Dudleys, Wolves come out for an interview segment. This sets up the series that they are going to have. I believe the first match, the straight match that we went to, is airing next week, and the first team to win two matches in this series will become the tag team champions. So that's essentially what they set up here. Mike Tenay did an interview from the bedroom of Dixie Carter. They inserted this into the show. I don't know when they taped it. Dixie is bedridden. She talked about her injuries, a broken back, fractured ribs, said that right now, she's going to take the time to focus on outside the ring affairs, business behind the scenes. But she did warn us, we have not seen the last of Dixie Carter. And Mike Tenay wanted to know what that meant. Dixie just said, we're done here. Interview's over. She blew on a flute, demanded that Serge, her husband, come in and fluff her pillows for her. Hopefully that wasn't some code name for sex. I hated this segment because it sets up a Dixie Carter return. I really thought that, maybe naively enough on my part, that the table bump was the blow-off for now for the Dixie Carter character. Not to say that Dixie never would have been back, but they would have kept her out at least for several months before they could no longer resist the temptation to bring her back. And she was gone for a week. They promoted this interview, so now she's back on my television screen, and she's back promising that she's going to be back on television again at some point soon. I don't need to see that. I don't need to see Dixie Carter back on TV. Let her stay at home, let her convalesce, and let her, as she said here, tend to affairs behind the scenes. Stay off the freaking show. They congratulated Christy Hemme, the announcers did, on getting herself knocked up. She is 6 months pregnant, expecting her first child. So congrats to her. That sound you heard is thousands of men weeping all over the world. Gail Kim and Angelina Love for the Knockouts Championship, last knockout standing. I take back what I said. I made a mistake. I said that Joe and Key had the best match on the show. They had a really good match, but believe it or not, I give those honors to Gail Kim and Angelina Love. I think these two women went in there, they blew away whatever expectations most people probably had for them. It's the best match of Angelina Love's career, bar none by far. I defy you to find me a better Angelina Love match than this. Gail Kim, she's had a ton of great matches. She made the knockouts division years ago with Awesome Kong. She had those great couple of matches last year with Taryn Terrell, who so far in her comeback has not looked anything like the Taryn Terrell we saw a year ago. And now she went out there, and they laid it all out on the line. They had weapons in the match. There was a great spot where Angelina Love gave Gail Kim a super kick, I guess her Botox injection. But Kim had the chair up. She had a steel chair in her hands, and the chair got knocked back right into her face. It looked and sounded brutal. But she somehow fought back from it, and the finish was Gail Kim giving Angelina Love basically a Samoan drop onto a steel chair in the ring. Angelina Love could not get up in time, and so she loses, and Gail Kim retains. This was a very, very good knockouts match that even got loud chants of better than Divas during the match. And to be perfectly honest with you, this was better than any Divas match I've seen in months. So I would definitely seek this out. Because Impact aired in a new time slot this week, and a lot of people missed the show, I think they got like 800,000 viewers this week. The rating was way down, but you expected the rating to be down. I would be concerned if they're still getting 800,000 people in 2 weeks. Then I would panic. But what they did was Spike TV on their website, I'm pretty sure it's on Spike's site, not the Impact site, they put the whole episode of Impact up there commercial free. So if you missed it and you want to just go back and maybe just watch this and just watch Joe and Low Key, which are well worth watching, you could find the full episode commercial free, ad free, on the Spike TV website. Just search around. It's on there. I was watching some of it yesterday. So just a little note to those of you who may have missed this. Main event was Six Sides of Steel. Bobby Roode, Eric Young, Austin Aries, Magnus, and Gunner, and James Storm. Can't forget about him. It was a cage match. What can I say? You know, there really wasn't a lot to it. You got six guys in there. And the rules of the match was escape only. No pinfall, no submission. You had to escape over the top and out to the floor. And I like that. I like cage matches that have the escape rule because I think I grew up on that, so that's probably why I like it. If you were an old school wrestling fan from the 70s, I think back then the rules were you're in the cage and it's pinfall or submission. I didn't grow up on that, so I don't hate the escape rule. To me, it's the natural way. You fight your opponent and you try to get the hell out of there as quickly as you can and drop to the floor. So what ended up happening was Bobby Roode and Eric Young did the old Hulk Hogan, Paul Orndorff Saturday Night's Main Event finish from 86 where they dropped down at the exact same time. Both hit the floor. They did a good job on the editing here because I think I said this when I talked about the spoilers and the taping results. I was front row right there that night, and when they did the match and Eric Young was on our side, he came down. It was obvious that Eric Young hit the floor first. So they did a good job on the editing here to make it look as though they came down simultaneously, even though they really did not. The referees were arguing. The wrestlers were arguing. That's how they went off the air. They went off the air with controversy. Who is the number one contender to Bobby Lashley's world championship? And that was the cliffhanger for the show. So that was Impact on Wednesday night. Again, you could check out the full episode. This won't be a weekly thing, but for this week, the episode in full is up on the Spike TV website. Let's get to the mailbag here. We have some questions, including audio questions, to get through. You can email them to me if you have questions. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. You can attach MP3 audio questions. Try to keep them limited to about 30 seconds or so, and always include your name and where you are from when you write in. Some people still don't do that. This first audio question comes to us from Too Cold Steve-O.
Hey there, Solomonster. It's Too Cold Steve-O here. And I was wondering, what would you think of Maurice coming back to the WWE as Miz's valet? I think it makes a lot of sense with The Miz acting all Hollywood and a movie star. If he comes to the ring with Maurice, you know, hand in hand, posing for the cameras, coming down the red carpet, it just makes sense.
Anything that gets Maurice back on TV is an idea that I approve, so I would be fine with that. It would just make Miz that much of a bigger heel. People would hate him even more if he was walking around with his just smoking hot wife. I see some of the photos that Maurice posts on her, like, her Instagram page and stuff like that, because I guess Miz will retweet it sometimes, and she looks as good as ever. I mean, she is just a stunningly beautiful woman, and so any excuse to get her back on TV gets my approval. This audio question comes to us all the way from Saudi Arabia.
Hello, Solo Monster. Abdulaziz Gamdi from Saudi Arabia. I just finished watching ROH Best in the World 2014. I especially loved the six-man mayhem match, the submission match between Cedric Alexander and Roderick Strong. Also, the world title match, Michael Elgin and Adam Cole. My question is, for someone who is new to ROH, what other pay-per-view or matches do you recommend me or other people to watch?
Great question. Thank you for sending it in. Some of the matches that come to mind for me, and bigger ROH fans listening to this may have a very different list. I don't have a list, but some of the matches that I think would be worth going out of your way to see, and a lot of them are very old, like years and years old, but CM Punk and Samoa Joe had an unbelievable series of matches in Ring of Honor. I would recommend you watch any of them, quite frankly. They go back to like 2004, 2005. One match in particular that gets a lot of praise, and I saw it a long time ago. I really should go back and watch it again soon just to refresh my memory. But Punk and Joe had, I think it was the second match in their feud. They went an hour in their first match, and they came back and went an hour in that match as well. And I think that match may have been even better than the first one. So Punk versus Joe, I would definitely check out, especially the second one. Bryan Danielson, Daniel Bryan, against Takeshi Morishima, Final Battle 2008. I'm pretty sure I was at that show. It was at the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York. Those two had a great feud, with Danielson legit suffering a detached retina at the hands of Morishima to build to this match. Bryan had to wear an eye patch on TV, and I think he may have even come out for some matches wearing an eye patch. It was a legitimate injury. It was very serious. But these guys went out there, they had a hard-hitting feud, and it was classic big man versus little man. You know, even back then, Danielson was a small guy, and Morishima was a big, heavyset dude who could go. And so they went out there, and they just had these great matches that in some ways reminded me of Sting and Big Van Vader back in the early 90s in WCW. Big man against smaller man. I don't think we can call Sting a little man, but he was certainly smaller than Vader. But Vader had a very stiff, hard-hitting style, and it just, they clicked. They had a great chemistry, and it made for some great matches in WCW, very similar, I think, to Danielson and Morishima in ROH. And Bryan Danielson against Kenta, who he has said Kenta is his all-time favorite opponent. Kenta just started with NXT. Hopefully a lot of you guys listening who aren't familiar with him will slowly become familiar with why Kenta is a big deal. I was also there for that match between Danielson and Kenta, so I may be a bit biased, but it's an excellent match. There's far too many great matches to name. A lot of them I probably haven't even seen myself. If you go back even further in ROH history, I really started to become an ROH fan and go to shows around 2006. I think 2006 was the very first show I went to. So I would say the matches I mentioned here are a good starting point. If you've never seen them before, go back and watch those, and then watch a few more, because there have been some classic wars in Ring of Honor over the years. And one, actually, I'll give you one more now that just came to mind, and this is a different kind of match. It's not so much a great wrestling match as much as it was it was quite the blow-off to a bitter feud between Kevin Steen and El Generico, the current Sami Zayn on NXT. They had a ladder war that may have been Final Battle 2010, don't quote me on that, but they had a ladder war that was just unbelievably brutal. Lots of just sick chair shots to the head and stuff that just makes me feel uncomfortable now when I watch it. But as far as a blow-off to a feud, and I'm pretty sure Generico won that match. That might have been the match that Generico won, and per the stipulations of the match, Steen had to leave ROH, which I think he did for about 6 months, and then he came back. You might want to check that one out, too. That was also an excellent match. Jonathan writes in, "This idea that the title is defended too much is such bullshit. I don't know how anybody can believe that. When was the last title match on live TV? When was the last title switch on live TV? Non-Money in the Bank. There hasn't been one in years. So how can you honestly say once a month is too much? It's absurd to think that an absentee champion is good. It sucks for people who buy tickets to TV and house shows, and it sucks for people who want to watch B pay-per-views. You have to be naive to buy that a title defense once a month is too much. If anything, it isn't defended enough. Strange thing is, the U.S. title hasn't been defended in months as of right now. It must be the most prestigious title on the planet, using this logic. It's typical favoritism nonsense. Dean Ambrose / Sheamus does not defend a title. People clamor about it being worthless, but when the plan is for Lesnar to hold the belt for months and not defend it, somehow it's a great idea. First of all, do yourself a favor and buy a hearing aid, because I don't ever remember ranting about how the title is defended too much. Okay? It's true. I've said that I would be okay with it not being defended on every single pay-per-view. Okay? It's happened before. Shawn Michaels was the champion in 1996 and had a great match with Mankind at Mind Games. And then the very next month at Buried Alive, Undertaker and Mankind headlined, and Michaels was doing commentary for the number one contenders match with Vader and Sid, which built to his next title defense at Survivor Series. Guess what? The world didn't end. Okay, they took their time to build it, build a title match that people might actually care about seeing. It had some history to it with Shawn and Sid being friends. So I just throw that out there as an example. Okay, now to your point about how Sheamus and Dean Ambrose don't defend their U.S. title for weeks and how the titles mean shit, let me school you, son. Okay, there's a big difference between being the WWE World Heavyweight Champion and being the Intercontinental Champion, or being the United States Champion. It wasn't always that way, okay? Those titles used to mean a hell of a lot more than they do now. There was actually a time when the U.S. title, back in the old NWA days, was almost on par with being the World Champion. And a lot of top guys held the belt. No top guys are holding the U.S. or Intercontinental titles today. It just doesn't happen. Back then, Dusty Rhodes would hold it. Ric Flair held it. Okay, so that was a bygone era. There's a big difference now, today, between the world title and the secondary titles. Those titles are secondary by nature, which means by their very nature, they should be defended more. Okay, there are far more mid-card wrestlers on that roster than main eventers. There's only so many main event spots to go around. Hell of a lot more mid-carders than main eventers on the WWE roster. That spot should be reserved for the most elite in the company. Everyone else is just fighting for second place. If you have a secondary title that's defended once every 3 months, nobody new gets elevated. In theory, of course. Okay, but here's the other flaw in your logic. Since you love painting with such a broad brush, WWE has done a horrendous job of making their champions, and then by association their titles, mean anything because of the way they treat their secondary champion. Sheamus may be the exception because he's still mostly protected. Most of the guys who hold the Intercontinental or the U.S. titles are not protected the way that Sheamus is. They routinely lose non-title matches on TV, and that's okay if the person who beats the champion then becomes the number one contender for that title. But how often does that actually happen? I joked about it earlier with the Diva stuff. Natalya now has 2 wins over the champion. Eva Marie had 2 wins over AJ back when she was the champion. Are they going to add them to the match at Night of Champions and make it a 4-way? I hope they do, because it's the only thing that makes sense. But watch them turn around and have another singles match between Paige and AJ, which is great, but it makes no sense, because the champion got pinned by somebody else twice on TV or made to submit. Since Paige tapped out to the sharpshooter when Natalya put her in theory, they should be number one contenders for the titles. But so often, they ignore it. They ignore it. It's lazy storytelling, or they think we're stupid. I don't know. Take your pick. But we see that countless times. I could count on one hand how often it actually happens that way, where the champion loses a non-title match on TV, and that person then goes on to get a title match on pay-per-view. Or even on TV. So they lose, and they lose, and they lose, and soon enough, people look at them as losers. Losers who happen to carry around a belt. That's not how you make your title seem important. Your champion should look strong. So now that I shot down your argument there, let's talk about the WWE title and Brock Lesnar. You can't fathom why people would support an absentee champion who only defends every few months. Brock Lesnar happens to be the WWE champion right now. Okay? He came from the UFC. Do you know how many times a champion defends their title in UFC? Once every few months, sometimes a little bit longer. Okay, I'm not advocating that WWE turn into UFC. What I'm saying is, that's how it works there, and it hasn't hurt their pay-per-view business. WWE's pay-per-view business had declined so much and sucked so bad, they decided it was worth the risk to just put them all on the network to help make the network a success at the expense of cannibalizing their entire pay-per-view business. You think if their pay-per-views were still pulling 400,000, 500,000, 600,000 buys a month or every few months, they would have had the balls to do that? I don't see too many people complaining that Jon Jones doesn't defend his title once a month. Brock Lesnar has been booked as this unstoppable monster. And if they continue to book him this way, and at the same time they start building up some new challengers for the title, like some of those names I discussed earlier, it'll mean that much more when Brock returns to defend his title. You're having a conniption fit because you're used to things being a certain way. You dislike change. I get that. I don't like change either. The title does not have to be defended at every house show. The title does not have to be defended on every pay-per-view. If you have other top guys who can carry the load and give people matches they want to see, like what we have now with Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose. Now, they need more than just those two guys. They've done a poor job of building up other people on the roster, like Cesaro and other people, but that's what they need to do. You can easily headline that Hell in a Cell pay-per-view in October with Rollins versus Ambrose inside the cell. And I'm just spitballing here, okay? Roman Reigns, maybe build up something against Bray Wyatt when his feud with Jericho runs its course. John Cena against somebody new like a Rusev. If Brock comes back and defends the title at Survivor Series, and then again at the Rumble, and again at Mania, the world will not end. Business will not die. But I guarantee you, those Brock Lesnar title defenses, those matches, are going to be must-see TV when they happen. So, eat your sour grapes and just relax. Ron, from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, what do you make of the TMZ story about Hulk Hogan being upset with Brock Lesnar for calling him old on Raw during Hogan's birthday party segment? Well, he is old. There's really not much else to say. And with Hogan, look, with Hogan, you never know where the show stops and reality begins. I can tell you this, the line where Brock Lesnar told Hulk Hogan, "Party's over, Grandpa," was not part of the script. Lesnar improvised that on his own. I thought it was the best line of the whole segment. I thought it was great. But it does make sense because I even said here on the podcast when I reviewed that whole thing, I'm surprised that Hogan would allow something like that to be said about him on TV. He's very protective of being called old on television. He's very protective of his image, even though he is old. So now it all makes sense. You know, he didn't see it coming because Brock came up with it on the spot. But Hogan being Hogan, he's playing it up more than it really is. I think he said something about Brock crossing a line when it comes to talking about Hogan's family. I have no idea what he's talking about there. I think it's just Hogan being Hogan. Maybe he's angling for a match, a title shot against Brock Lesnar because Brock beat him all those years ago. And Hogan, I don't know if you know the story or not, but Hulk Hogan has a bear hug loss on television, on SmackDown, at the hands of Brock Lesnar. It was the go-home show to SummerSlam in 02, right before Brock beat Rock to become the champion. Hogan lost in a bear hug on television and got the hell beaten out of him with a chair when the match was over. Very, very, very seldomly does Hogan allow himself to be booked in such weak fashion. As the story goes, the understanding was Hogan will do the job to this new guy on television, put him over as a monster, but Hogan wanted to come back to do the rematch at Survivor Series in Madison Square Garden, where he would beat Brock to become the champion. And thank God Vince McMahon said no, and that was the source of discontent between Hogan and WWE. Hogan went away. He didn't come back for many more months. He didn't come back until the following year when he did the feud with Vince heading into WrestleMania. That's why. So who knows? Maybe in his mind, Hogan has never gotten over that. It's one of the few blemishes on his record. You know, Yokozuna beat him, and Hogan never got his win back on Yokozuna. Now he can't. So maybe he wants to come back, and he wants to beat Brock for the belt. Would any of us be surprised if that really was his thought process here? I know he's angling for a match with Cena or Austin at WrestleMania. The match with Austin, it's not happening. The match with Cena, if he could somehow get cleared by doctors, yes. That of all the scenarios, that has the most likely shot of happening, and even that I don't think is going to happen. So I sure as hell hope he's not angling for a match with Brock, because even if he got one, not that he's going to win, but I don't think he could handle a match. I mean, he would be literally broken in half. We've heard JR say that before. Hulk Hogan, though, would literally be broken in half right in the middle of the ring, and I don't want to see that. Ross Underwood from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Had Mr. Perfect not left the WWF in late 1996, could you have seen him coming back to wrestling and being a main eventer and possibly WWF champion, or were his best days behind him? When Perfect came back in early 2002, what was the reason for putting other guys over on him and him hardly winning any matches or being in any major storylines? I've always thought a Mr. Perfect vs. Kurt Angle match at WrestleMania 18 in Canada could have been better instead of wasting Kurt Angle against Kane. I agree 100% with you. Perfect came back at the Royal Rumble in 02. I was psyched. I was stoked. I was always a big Mr. Perfect fan growing up, and not so much a Kurt Hennig fan in WCW. I wanted to hear the Mr. Perfect music, and I wanted him to come out there as Mr. Perfect. And he came out, and he was one of the last three or four guys in the Rumble that year. He had a great performance. He hung in there with Austin and Angle and Triple H there at the end before he got dumped out. And it seems like after that, they did nothing with him. He had one match on Raw against Stone Cold Steve Austin. I don't remember how soon after the Rumble it was. It couldn't have been that long after. Maybe within a month or two. I remember that match not being very good. And I think it was just Perfect was not the Perfect that he used to be. He may have had other issues. He may have been doing things he shouldn't have been doing that led in part to his death the following year. They did find, I think he died from acute cocaine intoxication, I think is what he officially died from. So who the hell knows what he was doing at that time? No drug testing policy in WWE, right? It was the Wild West compared to how it is now. He wasn't the Mr. Perfect that he had been. But I think motivated in the right feud with the right opponent on a grand stage like WrestleMania, absolutely. Kurt Hennig against Kurt Angle, Perfect against Angle would have been a great match. There was no reason for them not to do the match. Kurt Angle and Kane was not a feud that really went anywhere. It was not a feud that people were dying to see. Kurt Angle and Kane had one really, really good match together, maybe even great, for the U.S. title on SmackDown. I want to say that was in 2001. So Kurt Angle against Kane at WrestleMania, there was no reason to do that match. It was truly a waste of Kurt Angle, I agree. On that show, Mr. Perfect was in the opener. It was Rikishi and Too Cool and Albert against Perfect, Test, and Lance Storm. And I don't remember, I'm guessing that was the Sunday Night Heat match, because I don't remember that being on the pay-per-view. So he was relegated to Sunday Night Heat in a six-man tag, and his team lost. Why would you stick Mr. Perfect in a meaningless six-man tag that wasn't even on WrestleMania when you could have done Mr. Perfect against Kurt Angle? I think that could have been a hell of a match. And finally, we have one more audio question before we wrap up the mailbag. It was delivered at the last possible minute this morning from one Noah Mark.
Slobber Monster, it is me, Noah the Mark, crashing your audio question session. I just tweeted you a video of a 14-year-old Brian Blade live from the first ever Monday Night Raw at the Manhattan Center. We were both there. Yes, I know we're dating ourselves, but we were there in 1993 for the first ever Monday Night Raw, and I saw it on the Monday Night Wars episode 1 the other day on the WWE Network. Anyway, I had a question for you. Brian couldn't answer this, and maybe you can. Does the pedigree, Triple H's finishing move, have a generic name? If it didn't, what would you call it? Generically, of course.
Well, I always thought it was called a double underhook facebuster, which apparently it is, but I had to go search just to confirm that. But I have to point out something funny. When I went to search, I came across a page from WWE.com that is a Did You Know? And I have it open in front of me right now. It says, Did you know Triple H's pedigree is similar in technique and execution as the double underhook facebuster? However, the game's finishing maneuver is much more devastating. And I laughed at that because Triple H has not had a devastating pedigree in over 10 years. Stephanie McMahon, his wife, does a better pedigree now than Triple H does. It annoys me whenever he does the move, and like midway through the move, he lets go. He no longer hooks the guy's arms. He lets go, and the guy just kind of falls flat on his face. Doesn't look very devastating to me, but that's what it's called. Double underhook face buster, which the next time you send a question into me that late, you're going to get one of those. That's the mailbag. You can email me questions, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Right now we have a sound-off throwback to an episode from 1 year ago. It was sound-off episode 289, which was recorded on August 25th, 2013, 1 year almost to the day. An interesting part of the show as it pertains to Paul Heyman guys.
It's time to go back in time.
The problem here is Curtis Axel is not a strong enough opponent for CM Punk. You know, maybe Punk can help elevate him, but this feud is going to die a death if Paul Heyman doesn't find another guy to help take out Punk. And I think that person could very well be Ryback. He could be the next Paul Heyman guy. They've been doing the bully skits with him on TV. Supposedly, the WWE merchandise folks have been told to gear up some new Ryback items because he's going to be getting a big push. I don't know what else that could be other than a feud with CM Punk. Who else is he going to feud with? I'm not a real fan of the idea. I mean, it's kind of like been there, done that with Punk and Ryback. So the roles this time are reversed. This time Ryback is the heel and Punk is the babyface. So what? Who cares? I would much, much, much rather see Antonio Cesaro as Heyman's new hired muscle. I said this a few weeks ago on Sound Off during the mailbag segment. I think they made a big mistake by not putting Cesaro with Heyman the last time. And after watching his match with Sami Zayn on NXT this week, I'm even more convinced of it. This guy's got all the tools. And with Heyman as his mouthpiece, he's got it made. And the matches that we could get with Punk and Cesaro, I mean, would you rather see that or would you rather see another Punk versus Ryback match? Again, the Ryback thing is just speculation on my part. I don't know that Heyman is going to align with Ryback to take out Punk. But it's not too late to shift Cesaro over to Heyman if they want to do it. He can still keep Curtis Axel, just add Cesaro to his client roster. Well, I was right on both counts. Both guys did become Paul Heyman guys. I just wish things would have worked out a little bit better for Heyman and Cesaro, but through no fault of their own, didn't quite work out that way. And lastly, this week's sad tweet comes from the innovator of the sad tweet, at Zack Ryder, who on Wednesday morning, I guess once he got back off the road, tweeted, "Busy day today, gym, beach." Oh, that's it. Nothing more needs to be said. That's Zack Ryder in a nutshell. And he gives us our sad tweet for the week. If you have questions for the mailbag, please email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. And you can also friend me on Facebook, The Solomonster, with the extra E. That is my name on Facebook. We have a closed discussion group on Facebook, The Solomonster Sounds Off Facebook group. You have to apply for membership. And if you have sent in a request a while back and still have not been approved, you can drop me a note. Let me know. I'll go back in queue and see if I could find you, because I don't just blindly approve people. We try to keep it somewhat limited, so do consider joining us there. You can also subscribe to this podcast in iTunes. You can also stream us on Stitcher Radio, which I would very much appreciate. That helps our rankings on the sports charts on Stitcher. We're on TuneIn Radio as well. We have a free Android app in the Google Play Store. We have an unofficial fan-made sound-off app for Windows 8 users in the Windows 8 store, whatever that store is called. And you can subscribe to us on YouTube, the official Solomonster Sounds Off YouTube channel. Sound Off Extra going up earlier this past week with my full SummerSlam review, so do check that out and subscribe there for future videos. Make a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com if you want to show your support there. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname, and you can also show your support by signing up for a free 30-day Audible trial, audibletrial.com/solomonster. You get one free audio book that I know a lot of you have taken advantage of, and if you can get friends and family to do the same, if they're big readers or maybe they just would rather listen to their books instead of reading them, then Audible is the perfect service. Do share our URL with them, please. So that's going to do it for this week. We will be back with a brand new episode of the Sound Off 343 next weekend. Until then, be well. Unlike John Cena at SummerSlam, please stay safe. Don't step inside the ring with Brock Lesnar. And we'll see you right back here for a brand new episode next weekend. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Sala Monster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Solid into the cover, I'm telling you. Solid's the NXT Women's Champion.
The bad.
We officially strip Daniel Bryan of the WWE World Heavyweight Championship.
It's a good night to be right.
And the ugly.
I made the mistake of reading Vince Russo's blog. He talks about how it's not creative. No, it's the crowds that are dead, and it's all theme park visitors who come inside because it's too hot outside. 900 people did not wander into the fucking impact zone because grandma was about to keel over from heat stroke.
Well, mostly the good.
Some monster sounds off.
Since 2007. On the Salamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.